am alcoholic. I met this lady 8 years ago at a... Not a...
White Day wasn't a house of prostitution. It was at an AA meeting. And you know what? She just moved out. Yeah, she wasn't very sure after she asked me. But you know what? I met her at an AA meeting. She had a glow about her. Every time I see her, she has a glow. She's always helping females. She will talk to us men a little bit, but she's always... The sober females and the non-sober females... The sober females flock to her, and she flocks to the non-sober females trying to help them. She's a good example to me of what AA should be. A good example for me of what I want to be when I grow up. And, you know, she's a mid-aged woman, and look how handsome she is. How pretty she is.
And I love her.
Hi, everybody. My name is Pat McDade, and I am definitely an alcoholic. And I'm honored to be here tonight. I tell you, I'm from the Northeast Ohio area, Cleveland, and when we moved down here, you know, I'd been instructed, get to a meeting, get a sponsor, you know, do all the things to become part of AA. I went online, and there wasn't much. As I remember, there wasn't a whole lot on it. There probably was, but I couldn't find it. But anyway, so I went on a hunt, and I'd heard about the Howe Place. So my husband and I got in the car, and we started driving down Bell's Ferry. And I'm looking around, and they said it's behind a fire station. Well, there's a fire station farther north because I'm up off of Sixes Road. And so we pull in there, and it's a community, so that didn't work. So we get down to this fire station, and we pull in, and it's right behind it, and I'm looking, and we came around, and we pulled in, and I thought my husband was going to die. This is long before this, I'll tell you. And so there were a lot of motley looking people out in the front and, you know, smoking and talking and lots of motorcycles and everything. And you know, I knew they were my people. He had no idea what I was getting into, you know, because I sobered up and Lily's suburbia was sherry sippers, you know, kind of thing. And doesn't mean I was that, but I had put on a good act. So I said, he said, "Will you go in and you wave to me?" You know. So I said, "Don't worry about it." I went in and I never looked back because the Breakfast Club was my home group here for years, and we've since moved over farther east, and so I don't get over here with the traffic in the morning like I used to. But anyway, so the Howe Place became home to me before the home I moved into did, because I came here and I met my family, and whatever I left behind was here, you know, because I had great trepidation. I'd been up there for my sobriety date is March 18th, 1988. And I spent the first 19 years of my sobriety in Ohio. And it was really hard for me to leave because, you know, when you've been around that long and you walk into a room, everybody knows your name. It's a little bit like Cheers, but without the booze. And I was very, very scared. And I walked in here, and I met people like Danny and other people that were at that meeting. And I could breathe. I was having such a hard time adjusting. First of all, nobody talked like I did that I had run into, you know? And it was just all so new. And we had come down for grandchildren. My daughter and her family are here. And so, you know, I was clinging to them and to AA. And both of them really, then my heart came, I should say my heart came to Georgia. Anyway, I said my sobriety date is March 18th, 1988. And this good Irish-American girl could not go, you know, had to have that last hurrah on St. Patrick's Day, and I'll tell you about that in a little bit. But I came from I was the fifth of six children in an Irish Catholic family. I will tell you, I grew up in a house of love. It was just that kind of place that it was a lot of big brothers that were shoving each other around all the time and fooling around, and I had one sister, but there was active alcoholism in the home, and so I learned to dance around an alcoholic and play the game and all. And unfortunately, my dad, and he committed suicide on a dry drunk when I was 21 years old. And having tried or been, apparently, I did not know it at the time, but in and out of AA. And in fact, he previous to that, before AA had come to our little, it was a little small town of 7,000 people I grew up in, he'd had some of the treatments that you hear about in the psych ward that they thought would alleviate alcoholism. They're pretty brutal. And but then he couldn't not drink. And it got to the point where he couldn't not drink and he couldn't drink. And that is hell. And so he did take his life. And I'll tell you, it's hard. I lost a 55-year-old nephew last November who shot himself in the head. Couldn't get drunk and couldn't get sober. You know, one of those things. And it just, I'll tell you, if we don't stay here, we're going to die someplace. And I know what will die first is my soul. And that's what's going on for me. So anyway, grew up in this nice little town, and, you know, we had the soda, I'm old. The soda stand with the jukebox at every table, and went through school. I'll say my skin didn't fit. It really didn't, but a lot of people's didn't. I know so much more now about what was I thought was normal then, probably wasn't, but it was my normal. And so I don't remember having a lot of trepidation, a lot of issues. We didn't have time, to be perfectly honest. We were, if you didn't work after school, you were doing something after school and all. Anyway, I know that there was drinking going on in the high school, some of the football players and all that kind of thing, but I really, I went through Catholic school and I was a rule follower. You follow rules when you go to Catholic school. And then I got into the public high school and I started smoking. And oh my God, you know, I thought I died and went to heaven, and because I was bad, and then I remember when I graduated from high school, I graduated in '63, and I turned 18 that same month. And in New York State, it's legal to drink illegal to drink at 18, and so my boyfriend took me out and ordered me a Tom Collins, and I got to tell you something. I couldn't believe how good I looked after Tom Collins. Wow. You know, I know I lit up because I felt it in my fingers and in my toes. It didn't take much. I wasn't often running. I liked it. It, you know, partying became partying. It didn't become a lifestyle. But it wasn't long after that. I think I was like 20 or 21, and I'd been away to a college in upstate New York for fall weekend, and that's when they were serving Johnny Walker Red Scotch, and that I found my elixir of the gods, and I'm here to tell you, I started on Johnny Walker Red, and when I quit drinking at 42 years old, I was drinking Inverhouse, okay? And anybody that's drunk scotch knows where I went. And I remember standing in a grocery store about 10 years ago, and the liquor counter was next to the cash registers. And I'm waiting in line, and I look, and, you know, here's Chivas Regal and Johnny Walker Black and all. And then you go down, there's J&B and stuff, and then you're going down, and down on the bottom shelf was Inverhouse. And that's how my life went. I went from top shelf to bottom shelf. And that that I loved it. I loved it. And I think, I really think that that's when I found out that booze was the answer. And I, so I had been going to business school in Syracuse, New York. I moved to Washington, D.C. And when I was in Washington, I met my husband. We'll be celebrating 48 years of marriage next week. And I found my hostage. I found my knight in shining armor. He was shining, so he had a Mercedes. He was a naval aviator. Okay, he had all these credentials that I knew that he would take care of me the way I wanted to become accustomed. And he did. He did. And great guy. Still is a great guy. You know, he wasn't a great guy when I got here. Trust me. You know, he was definitely the problem. So anyway, so we started dating, and alcohol had become part of my life at that point. And we married and had our first child. And we would party, but that was like on weekends. You know, it wasn't during the week or anything. And when I say party, I mean get drunk. I'm not saying have... it was so funny when we first got married. You know, I came from the Ozzie and Harriet times where, you know, your husband came home from work and you had a cocktail waiting and you had some cheese and crackers and all, and you sat down with your spouse and you talked about the day, and then you went and had dinner and with the, you know, and the kids were there and everything. And so I had already reached a point where I wanted that drink at night. So I set that up for us that I, you know, he'd come home from work and I had this whole thing going. Well, it went right over his head. You know, first of all, he's a beer drinker. So why am I putting out the big to-do? But also, he couldn't figure out why that was so important to me. And it wasn't that I was trying to be, you know, swell and a hot shot. It's just it was legal for me to drink then. And then, but when we partied, I remember with the first St. Patrick's Day we were married, or second, whatever, we had a 5-month-old baby. And we were having a St. Patrick's Day party at our apartment. And we dyed the beer, you know, had the keg and dyed it green and the whole thing. And I really tied one on. And everybody had left, and he knew I was pretty lit. And he went to bed, and I was cleaning up. And I was already to the point where I can't realize how fast this disease goes. But I was, there were a lot of drinks left over and cigarette butts, and I was taking the sieve and sieving out the cigarette butts to drink. Yeah. Well, you'd have enough to drink, you don't think about it, you know, because you need more. So anyway, that was going on, and we lived in an apartment, and the garbage room was downstairs, and so I went to open up the apartment door, and we had one of those little chain locks, and I opened up the apartment door, and I ripped the chain lock right out of the wall, and I got really scared, because I had this 5-month baby sleeping, you know, in the next room. So that's when I went into controlled drinking, because I was so scared that I wouldn't be able to take care of that child if he needed me. And the way I controlled my drinking is I got to drink one weekend, and then my husband was allowed to drink the other weekend if he wanted to. Okay, but one of us, you know, and he wasn't a drinker. I mean, he'd have a few beers. Yeah. I don't think I've seen the man drunk 5 times in my life. Okay? And but I'd already put up the parameters on what would be acceptable. In order, my disease was already protecting itself, and life goes on. And we had 4 kids, and we had been living in Michigan, and ended up going into Cleveland. And life was happening, and I was becoming more and more irritable and discontent. And it was him, and it was the kids. And it was the dog, and it was everything but me. And that's when alcohol became my medicine. I needed that to do life. And I had already started hiding my booze, you know, watering it down, making lists of what state store or liquor store I'd been to that week, so they didn't think I had a problem, like they cared, right? And I got involved in, I'd always practiced my religion, but I got more involved. And we had a program going at the church, and I initiated the fact that we should have wine and cheese while we're there. Reading the Bible or whatever we were doing, you know, how nice that would be. So I kept bringing alcohol into whatever I was doing. And I'll never forget, one night I was leaving that meeting, and it was very snowy. And I needed more than the wine that we'd had. And then you could get this, I don't know what you call it, but you could buy booze, but it was all watered down, like at a 7-Eleven or something. And I had stopped, and my husband was out of town. The kids were old enough to, my oldest one was old enough to be at home alone with the kids while I was at church. And I remember I stopped and I bought that bottle, and I left the parking lot, and I was going down the snowy road, and I thought, I can't do this. I cannot do this, okay? And I threw the bottle. It hadn't been opened. I was taken home. I threw the bottle out the window, and it went in a snowbank. And I got home, and things were uncommonly nice at home after four kids had been, you know, there, and the dishes were even done. And I went upstairs, and I got into bed, and don't you know that booze was calling my name? Patty, I'm cold, whatever, you know. And I got up, and I had on my bathrobe and my nightgown, and I pulled on some boots, and I drove out, and I found that bottle. Okay, it was my normal. I thought how clever I remembered where I threw it. And, you know, seriously, I mean, that's what I'm thinking. And so I got the bottle, went home, got drunk, passed out, went to bed, got up, did the day. And from then on, my mom had come to live with us, and she became very ill, and she passed away. And it was in that time that my alcoholism went out of control. And she passed away in 85, and I sobered up in 88. And from then on, if I wasn't drinking, I was recovering from drinking. I was planning the drink. I was hiding the drink. And I had started isolating. I gave up extracurricular activities. I was very cautious about my children. And I had a counter, an island in our kitchen, and I found myself, I hated it when I was half drunk because I knew what I was doing and I couldn't not do it. And I remember standing there, and by then I had my scotch under the kitchen sink with a straw in it because I could lean over and put garbage in and take a slug. And but I had a bottle, and anybody that remembers this, Gallo wine was in these huge, heavy glass jugs with the big handle, and I'd have one of those on the counter, okay? And if you have the big jug, you can't see it. I'm thinking the kids are watching me. The paranoia was crazy. They were, actually. But I didn't, you know, but the paranoia was off the chart. And so I would sip wine then, but I had the scotch going down here. And you know the story. It just got worse and worse. And the last, you know what, it's interesting. I didn't lose anything, but I was dying inside, you know. And I would leave the house, and I looked like I stepped out of a bandbox. I mean, but I have a picture of myself the Thanksgiving before I sobered up, and I am so bloated, you know. And I think I'm looking good, and I look awful. And in my mind, you know, I should have looked better, whatever. But anyway, so that summer in July, we were at a 4th of July party in the neighborhood. And I hadn't been asked out of any places yet, okay? Pretty much everybody else was there. It's her. And but we were at this 4th of July party, and as I remember it, I was up on the hood of a car or the roof of a car, and it's still daytime, and I can see me right now with it. And I'm up there. I got a bottle, and I'm belting out Elvira. Now, if you're old enough to know Elvira, that was pop boom, you know, whatever. And I looked down, and it was a family party, and I looked down, and my 12-year-old daughter, or 13-year-old daughter, was looking up at me, and the look on her face broke my heart. And what could I do? What could I do? And I remember my husband helped me down. I can see him putting his hand up to help me down. And I went back into the house of the host and hostess, and the only thing I could do was pour a drink. That's, you know, how do you kill that pain? How do you kill that pain? And then we were at a party that next month, and Bill ushered me out. I mean, after that, you know, I'll be perfectly honest, I was a 5 o'clock drinker, but I would sweat it out from 8 in the morning till 5 o'clock, except on weekends because there's mimosas and there's, you know, you go to a brunch or whatever. And but I had those rules, and that was one of them. But I'll tell you, I was dying. And I just remember, you know, the last couple of months, I was pouring more booze down my sink than I was drinking because I'd go out, I'd get it at 3 o'clock, I'd wait till 5 to open it, and then I'd get drunk and pass out on the stairs going up or whatever. Meanwhile, the kids have exited the kitchen right after, you know. I used to say I have these wonderful kids. They go to their room, they study, they read books, and everything. They were escaping, you know, literally, from me standing at this island pontificating while I had the wine here and the scotch down there. And I Oh, okay. So we moved. All right, we moved into another house, which was I was never going to drink in this house. Okay, it's over. I can do this, and we moved around Christmas time, and I didn't last 4 hours. I didn't last 4 hours. That I was tired. Nobody was doing it my way. And you're so ungrateful that I have moved you to this wonderful house. And I remembered tying one on that night, and then for the next 4 or 5 months until March, or 3 months till March, I would start at 5, 4:30, whatever, and I didn't last till 8 o'clock, and then I'd come down in the morning, and that bottle, what was left of it, was sitting there, and I poured that out with tears streaming down my face. I didn't want to be that mother. I didn't want to have the house I grew up in. You know, at this point, my husband was doing a lot of traveling, so he wasn't cognizant of how bad it was. And I just know when my mom, because my mom had passed away, and for 3 years, he thought I was crying all the time because of sorrow. But I was like my dad. I was a maudlin drunk. I would be so sad and so full of self-pity. Now, I have a sister that's got a problem, and she's nasty. And I wasn't like her, so I wasn't that bad, you know, in my mind. I was having a lot of emotional problems. And so I had signed up for... I was still involved in my church, and I had signed up for a retreat that it was being put on. And the title of the retreat was Healing the Heart Within. Oh, boy, for this victim of life in general, they had my number. They were, you know, they had my number. And I went out to, I drove out there. It was on Lake Erie. We were, you know, about 25 minutes from Lake Erie, and it was out on Lake Erie, and it was a snowy day on March 18th, and I'd had a terrible St. Patrick's Day on my own. My husband and two of my sons had been away for a St. Patrick's event, and my daughter was in the house, and I decided to have a St. Patrick's Day party with myself. And so I, you got to have one, right? And so I did get a bottle of Johnny Walker Red, which I dyed green. And I was a lady in this mind. I was a lady, and I always had to have something with me to eat if I drank, because ladies don't drink except socially and with the, you know, blah blah blah. And so I had these little things they used to put in lunches. They probably still do, and they're in cellophane. And I had this one that was so crumbled because it had a lot of traveling. And so I got that and my Johnny Walker and a candle, and I was wearing my best drinking bathrobe. And I went up into my room, and we had a walk-in closet, and I locked my bedroom door, and I went into the closet, and I shut the door, and I lit the candle, and I had a tape of Danny Boy, and I had my booze. And so I am a closet drinker, and, you know. But anyway, I sat down on the floor and I started to drink, and I couldn't get drunk. I knew I was slurring my words because I was singing, okay. But I couldn't get numb. You know, it wasn't working for me anymore. And my husband called. It could have been 11 o'clock. Could have been 12 o'clock. I don't know when. My husband called and to check in, say hi, and whatever. And I, you know how when you're slurring your words, and you know you're slurring your words, but you don't want to slur your words, so, hello? And he said, how are things, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, whatever. And he said, I'll call you tomorrow, and hung up. And, you know, and it was, it talk about a bottom. You know, an emotional bottom. I was desperate. I just could not believe. And I looked in the mirror as I was walking back to my closet. And the sight. This isn't me. This isn't me. And I went back and sat down at my party. And thank God I didn't burn down that house with a candle in a closet full of clothes. I mean, but I sat down, and I just said, dear God, please help me. Please help me. And I got up, luckily put out the candle, and as I remembered, I was in bed when I awakened the next morning. And I was going on the retreat the next day, and I prepared for it. I had had a big 2-liter bottle of Diet Pepsi that I poured out and filled up with booze to take with me, and I had signed up for a single room so I could drink at night like I had to, and I packed up some food to have in the room because you eat when you drink, supposedly. I don't ever remember doing that, but you're supposed to. And I took myself out to this retreat, and I arrived on the grounds, and the snow was falling, and there were spotlights on the parking lot and all, and I was a mess. I was an absolute mess. I hadn't had a drink that day. And I got out of the car, and I opened the trunk to get my suitcase out, and there was the bottle of Pepsi in a brown paper bag, and I was all, you know, going to take it in and do my thing, and nobody would know, and the whole thing, and I took it out of the car, and I opened it up, and I poured it out on the snow. And then I thought, oh, my God, what have I done? And I walked into the building, and I'll tell you, I was terrified. And there was a man there who was facilitating the retreat. And, you know, I was living in Cleveland, Ohio. I was living, our home was 15 minutes from Dr. Bob's house, okay? The birthplace of AA, I don't think I ever heard of it. Now, that doesn't mean it wasn't, you know, first of all, we don't publicize, and back then you really didn't. But when there was Founders Day, it was in the paper. They just didn't, and they took pictures, but not of people. You know, they, that kind of thing. And but anyway, so this man that was leading the retreat was a recovering alcoholic, and I'd never heard of one. Most everyone in my family that had alcoholism had died of it in one way or another. And he told his story, and he didn't have six sentences out, and I started to cry. And over the course of the weekend, you know, I related more and more about what he was talking about. And he did talk about AA, but he talked about it in snippets because that's what he was talking about, what had broken his heart and why his needed to be healed. And by Sunday morning, I was a mess. And not that I hadn't been a mess before, but when we were getting ready to leave, he said, "Are you okay?" And I started to cry. Still, continued, whatever. And I said, "I think I'm an alcoholic." And he said, "Okay." He said, and he gave me a book. Because there's almost 1,200 meetings in the greater Cleveland Akron area up there. And he gave me the book of meetings. And I said, "But you don't understand, I'm a woman alcoholic." Which was the lowest of the lows in my book. And he laughed at me. You know how they talk about in here that there's a, you know, the sponsor laughed when they said something, and new sponsee, and he said, "You know, I think you'll find a few." And so I went home, and now I feel stripped naked. Not only did I not have the booze, and I don't know, I don't know why sobering up physically those 2 days didn't seem to be a problem, but I was such a mess I didn't know if it was or not. But when I got home and my husband was home and I told him what had happened and that I would need to go to AA, and he said to me, "Whatever you have to do, I just want you to be happy." And he's been that way ever since in my recovery. Nothing has come in the way of my program and my recovery with my any of my family. And so I drove past several AA meetings, probably five or six, and it took me a week and a half to get to a meeting, but I didn't drink. And I couldn't believe it. That's why, what a miracle to have that obsession removed the way I drank. I mean, what a miracle. I mean, it was no longer an option. I wish I could do that with sugar. You know, okay, I'm done with sugar. You know, whatever. But that's not my problem. You know, it's not the same thing. That is not a soul sickness. You know, that's just sugar. And so I walked into my first meeting. I remember, because I knew I had to get there. You know, I've been hanging on to the grace of that prayer long enough. And I climbed, it could have been 20, I thought it was 20 flights of stairs, but I think it was three, up into a church. And I stood outside and I thought, this can't be the right place, because I heard laughter, I heard talking, I heard some children, the music of AA. You know, when do we walk into these rooms that we have a glum lot? You know, it's usually Danny leading the crowd, you know. But anyway, and I walked into that room, and I've never looked back. I've never looked back. And I am so grateful for that. And to this day, I am so grateful for that, because this alcoholic does not have another recovery in her. I have been to so many AA funerals. Some of them, you know, people just... To drink is to die. You know, that's bottom line, to drink is to die for me. And I was very lucky in the women that were around. It was a women's meeting. I went to the women that were around me, and that two women picked me up every night, every weekday night for 2 weeks, and took me to meetings and introduced me around, and then said, "Okay, now you're on your own. You know where we are. You get there." You know, the thing is, not one of my children ever said, "Mom, please don't go out." please stay home tonight, because of the way our house was and the way the nights were in our house. Never, you know, never, gee, can you stay home tonight? It was like, bye. She's gone. And that started my journey. And my I got a Nazi sponsor, holy cow, and which is, you know, loving, sweet, but I would, you know, we started working the steps, and it was one of those call me every day, and I'd call her, and I'd have to, I was really nice, I'd say, how are you, isn't it a beautiful day, and then I was starting my litany of them, and I'd go, Bill, my husband, Bill, she'd go, leave him alone, if you're not the problem, there is no solution. Okay? And I'd go, yeah, but. You know? But she was such a power of example, and she led it the roundup several years ago, and has been pretty much, what, a circuit speaker? She's common as an old shoe. She certainly doesn't have any ears about her, but she's got quite a story. And she lost two children as a result of her alcoholism. One was born with fetal alcohol syndrome, and the other one died during a seizure that she was too drunk to help the child. And she was such a power to me that if she could forgive herself, and as I proceeded in the steps and discovered that I, you know, the havoc in the hell, that it was hell for our house, that was created because of my drinking, my alcoholism, and my thinking. And if she could forgive herself for what happened during her drinking, then I knew that she would help me be able to go there. And, you know, the steps opened a whole world to me of accountability, forgiveness. I had a God of my life, but the God that I have, the higher power that I have gained in AA is not limited. You know, I had kind of a God in the box. You know, the dear God, please help me, God. And the God of my religion, which some people in my religion thinks he's all over the place. I didn't. You know, he was in church. When I left, he was gone. And when there's a hiccup, you know, God's there. Today, but something I found, and I went, thanks, God. You know, that kind of stuff. It's just become part of my life. But the healing, the joy, I will tell you that my children now range from 48 down to 39. Oh, my God, how'd that happen? And we have a real family. My grandchildren have never seen me drink. My children's memories have been, they've subsided to some extent. There's still stuff, but it's stuff, and it's not mine anymore. And they're beautiful, good citizens of the world, and not necessarily just because of my recovery, but their dad did a great job. My husband and my relationship has matured. He married a little girl who had no more idea how to do life without a drink than the man in the moon. And I was a pretty wild child. I mean, I remember taking off to that weekend that I was introduced to scotch. I remember jumping in a car with a bunch of people when I lived in Washington, D.C., and going up to New York for the St. Patrick's Day parade. I didn't know them. They didn't know me. You know, just read between the lines. And, you know, so I had my parties and all. But when I got married, I didn't need to. I had a bar at home, and I had a man that would support my whim, whatever it may be. And I sit here like this because I'm absolutely baffled on how I ended up here, you know, because it was lined up for me to die an alcoholic death until my higher power was able to come into that little bitty window I opened up into my soul. And, you know, I don't mean to belittle the steps by not going through them, but they work. They work in order. I use them in my daily life. One of the traditions my kids love is that I should have no opinion on outside issues, and anything in their adult lives is an outside issue. Mom, they'll go, Mom, you know. And, you know, because I, my youngest son came to the Sunday morning meeting once with me, and he was here, and some of the women might remember that he was here. But anyway, so on the way home, I said to him, what did you think about the meeting and all? Because he was 10 when I sobered up. So he heard me on the phone. And when he was 12, I remember I was nagging him about his room or something. He turned to me and said, I'm not going to give you free rent in my head. You know, I thought, okay, I don't hang around my phone calls. You don't need to be that healthy. But and we left, and we were driving home, and I said, well, what did you think about the meetings? And he was so impressed by the traditions. When we read the traditions, that an organization could function on these traditions. And I thought that was a pretty amazing observation of his. Anyway, what is it like? I picked up on that. It says in the How It Works, we say generally what we used to be like, what happened to what we're like now. So what am I like now? I like me now. Okay? I do. I'm happy now. I don't second guess myself like I used to. I don't need to drink. I don't have to drink. I had to drink. As I look back on it and the way I sweated through a day of not drinking, and it befuddled me. I couldn't function. I couldn't think. It was so possessed. I was so possessed. So anyway, in doing the steps, I have found a new happiness and new freedom. I am no longer the problem in the house. I am no longer the problem of society. And I am no longer a problem to me. And I do know today, and I had a wonderful day today, I do know that today I did the best I could. And that is such a different thing from the guilt, shame, and remorse. And I don't care if you're 16 coming in here or 60 coming in here, we're all the same. Stories may be different, feelings are the same, the steps work the same. And I only know that because that's how it worked for me, and it's worked with people that I've sponsored and that have sponsored me. And as I said, I'm a different person in the last 3 or 4 years have been really tough for me, probably the toughest of my sobriety since the first couple. And I cannot believe that going through the process again thoroughly, how much has been lifted and how much more alive I feel. And because I had a soul sickness long before my body gave out, because I really apparently didn't have a lot of physical ramifications. But the soul sickness, and I know today my soul will die if I pick up a drink. And one of the things that scared me, I say to drink is to die. What if I don't die and my soul is dead? You know, talk about being in hell. And so anyway, I'm glad to have been asked to do this. I'm honored to stand here and say that I am an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thank every one of you whom I know and I don't know for giving me the gift of sobriety. So thank you.